Hi everyone, welcome to Writing Your Own GoLinter, automated code review brought to you by Patrick. Enjoy.
Okay, so welcome to the second to last talk for the DHCP. Probably feels weird to talk to a English to a room full of German speaking people, but this is also recorded and streamed, so you can enjoy this. For context, I didn't have much time preparing this talk because I've been busy with event organization at DHCP, so you're getting a already prepared talk that I held for an internal developer conference at Schwarz IT. This is why the slides are not DHCP themed, but work themed. We can just ignore it. I think the content is the more important thing. So, basically, we have the topic of linters. First of all, what are linters exactly? We're going to dive a bit into what linters exist for Go, what we have here. For example, with Go, we have a built-in linter. So a linter is a tool that allows you to automatically check your code. So if you write something, send it to a colleague, then the colleague has to check all the same things over and over again, making sure best practices are kept and so on. And with a linter, you can automate lots of things, like formatting, making sure that no variables that are unused are present in the code anymore, because that's usually a sign of things that didn't really get completed and so on. So with a linter, there's lots of automated checks that are way more efficient implemented than any AI check or something that you probably would use today if linters weren't invented yet, could ever dream of being. So what do we have here? Go has some linters already supplied with the toolchain. So when you install the Go runtime, you get this for free, basically. We have govet, which is a command you can just call on your code. It has about 35 linter rules, not that many, but it's a linter rule set that evolves with the language together. So anytime the Go team introduces a new language feature or something like that, which also could benefit of a linter rule, they will add it to Go vet, and it will automatically extend the kind of tests that are being run against your code. A subset of these linter rules also runs together with Go test. So if you have test coverage in your Go in your Go application, it will automatically run some of the linter rules that are considered basic and don't really produce many false positive. They just run automatically together with your test suite. And then, of course, we have community-provided linters, which is Golang CI Lint. It's an aggregator of community rules. So basically, people just wrote their own linters for a specific purpose with their own, let's parse the whole Go code in order to get an abstract syntax tree, something we will talk about later, and then feed it into the linter code and then print all the results. And that's not very efficient, because for every of these linter rules, you need to read the Go code or parse the Go code, process the data, the AST data, and then print out the results, and do that for all of the linters that you want to have. So some people came up with the idea of a linter aggregator, which is Golang CI Lint. This will parse the Go code once, feed it to all the linters, then aggregate all the results and print you a report. And it does so with a lot of linters. I didn't count them for that. Lots of these linters have multiple rules on their own that you can enable with the config. It runs these linters in parallel and so on, and it caches the intermediate results. And and this is so important to do on your code, because it catches problems early, that we have an internal rule that you should use this with a standardized config that we provide in the company. And I would say, if you have any power in your software engineering organization to establish a rule like this, you should use a linter. Now is the question. So for JavaScript, we have the same. We have ESLint. There are also some other linters that you can use. But ESLint is basically the default, so you probably also want to use one for JavaScript. So the question is now, we have these linters. They're good. You should use them in your software development lifecycle. And The problem is now, why would you even want to write our own linter? This is cool for cases where a standard rule doesn't really fit anything. Like you have something project specific, like all of your services need to implement a specific endpoint or something like that, or you want any data modification to be automatically integrated into your audit logging, and you need to call one function, and you need to make sure that this function is being called whenever data is modified, because you have various storage methods, and you don't want to hook into all of them, but you want to make sure, okay, anytime someone modifies data, this function is called. This is something you can easily do with a linter. So we want to write our own linter now. We discovered, hey, our engineers are constantly checking for the same thing in the code review. They're getting annoyed by it. Some things are slipping. You notice that some pull requests got merged without checking each of these things. So now we want to write our own linter. But how do these work? What we have to understand first is that lots of compilers basically work with a so-called abstract syntax tree. This is a tree. This is just a part expression. We have this format.println hello world, which is a basic hello world statement. It's not a complete program. We're looking at a complete program later. But this is just for printing hello world. And on the left side, we have what the compiler sees after parsing this into an abstract syntax tree. First of all, we have the call expression here. So we want to call something. This is what the whole thing here is doing. Then, of course, it has two children. One thing is the function that we want to call, and the other one are the arguments in this function call. The arguments here is just a literal, so a basic literal or basic lit, how it's called in Indigo abstract syntax tree. And it's a string, and the value is hello world. That's the easy part. Then we want to call something. And what we want to call here is format.println. And this is more of a complex statement or complex expression itself. It has something that, first of all, we need to specify from what exactly we want to call it, then we want to specify which function we want to call. So we want to call the function println in the format package. It's not just a simple function name. So to express this idea, we have a selector expression. We're selecting something from, in this case, a package, but we could also select something from a class or a struct in whatever programming language you have. Basically, these abstract syntax tree kind of look all the same in other programming languages. Of course, if the language follows a completely different paradigm, the abstract syntax tree will also represent it. But for most imperative or object-oriented languages, abstract syntax tree will basically look like this. And after we've cleared up the selector concept, we have the individual parts, the part in front of the dot and the part behind the dot. We have the selector, which is the thing we're selecting, which means print line in this case. And we have whatever we are selecting from, which is just X, because it could be just as well another selector expression. If you have deeply nested things like something dot something dot something, then you would have also deeply nested selector expressions in the X part here. So this is the thing we have to work with when writing linters. We're writing a program that takes in this kind of tree, and we want to find the interesting parts in it. Because this doesn't really look like just exactly this. If we want to find all instances of a print line function call, we need to check for this within the whole application abstract syntax tree. So this is the other part that it contains. And this call expression is just one tiny part in the whole program's abstract syntax tree. At the top, we have a file. In this case, it also has the file name, which package it belongs to, and so on. We have this package statement on this side here, belongs to the file node here. We have an import spec, which is this line here. We want to import something. Like in this case, we need to import the format package where we can call println on, which is this import spec. And this also has a child called a basic literal, which is, again, here this format, FMT string literal. which is part of the path child element. Then we have a function declaration, which is this main function here. We need to declare it, so it gets its own node, a function declaration. This can also have parameters and so on that you can pass to this, but in this case, there are no parameters, so there's no node. And for the body, so all of this, we have a block statement. And in this block statement, we have the children nodes of this abstract syntax tree. And now, to reiterate, we have to find the interesting part in this abstract syntax tree. How do we do that? These libraries that where we can represent the abstract syntax tree often have so-called traversal helpers based on the visitor pattern. So we don't need to descend onto our abstract syntax tree on our own. We can just tell it, please call this callback for every node that we want to visit, and then we can filter out all the things we want to see, and we can skip the parts that we don't want to see. So in this case, for example, in Go, it's ast.inspect. The file, which is our root of the abstract syntax tree, we just pass that in, and it will go down to all children and call this function here with each node as a parameter. And in this case, we want to filter only calls that are to a function called myfunc. And this is how we would do that. We have a bool return parameter, which says we want to descend further into the tree. If we return false here, then we are not interested in any further nodes below this. So we can skip parts of the abstract syntax tree and allow for faster runtime because we don't need to care about those. And if we return true, then we can go into that. For example, here we just say, yeah, we're not interested in any call expressions that are not for a function called myfunc, so we can skip them. So this is how we would go ahead, and then for anything else, we just return true. And our fun part, that's what we want to do, just belongs here somewhere. The same thing basically works for ESLint. So you can see here the similarities. We have a callback, especially for a call expression, and this is the callback that will be called. And here we can say we just want to call a filter based on things that have an identifier. And once we've established that, we can check if this is myfunc. And that's it. So here, these are ways we can filter down this abstract syntax tree, make it a bit more manageable, and then implement our own logic at that point when we found something interesting. So the focus here is the Go example that we want to do. I'll just go through the code, explain a bit about it, and then you can take a look at it. What we want to do, first of all, this AST has some various types. This is a helper slide for workshop participants that I prepared, so we can look up some things. But things are pretty self-explanatory. So a function call will be represented by a call expression. A selection, so a.b, by a selector expression. An identifier is an ident. We also have some types for generic nodes, generic expressions, and so on. And we have a cool package in the extended standard library. So anything below golang.org/x is part of the extended standard library. It doesn't have these compatibility guarantees as much as the normal standard library has that is just imports without any URLs. But this is basically part of the standard library, and any linter out there for Go implement or uses this package basically to work. What we have to do is we need to create an instance of the analyzer. So we can specify a name, some documentation comments, some flags that we want to pass to it, maybe for configuration, and most importantly, a run function. This run function is our main callback, our main entry point into the linter. And it will be passed a parameter of pass. And this is the thing below here. We have a function called report, where you can say, oh, we found something, we want to report something. We have all the files, and as you remember, ast.files is our root of our abstract syntax tree. that's where it begins. So we can use those files to start descending into the abstract syntax tree for each file. We also need some more stuff to navigate this abstract syntax tree, for example, a file set called fset, the package information, and the cool thing is, in Go, it's a fully typed language, so we get some type information. And this is what we have on the other side here. We get lots of type information. Basically, for any expression, we can say what type is the result type of this expression. We can say what instances of variables do we have and what's the type of that. Some definitions that we want to know the type of. It's basically just a map lookup away. We just need to say, please give me the type of this instance here. It's an identifier, so we need to find that in the abstract syntax tree. It's a pointer to an identifier, so we need to find the exact identifier. And we can just say, please look this up, and then we get an instance information and get the type information at compile time. So this is basically the framework that we can use to build our own linter. And we just have to pass in the relevant things, like a run function, and then we need to process. I see some very disappointed faces. Did you write it without this? Okay, that's good. Because you can write it, of course, you can write it without it. You can manually parse the Go files. You can manually print out some diagnostics. But that would be probably just way too much work because it's already being done for you. So we now have some example code. Hope we can see that here and hope it's all possible to see. So one thing I want to say before we look at the backend code here, it's all within one file. It's not according to best practices. I wouldn't write Go like this, but it just serves as a neat example that we can run a linter against and which has some problems, of course. So this is just a basic server that is a to-do list, which is, I think, a common example. So we have some post endpoints for creating a to-do. We have a get on the to-do, so we can list the to-dos. And we have a put to mark these to-dos as done, or update some deadline or something like that. So just the most basic functionality. And we want to have some custom linting rule for this. We want to make sure that any parameter, for example, we have here in the path, is formatted according to snake case. For those who don't know what snake case is, it's basically, it would be to-do ID with an underscore separating to-do and ID. Or we can also do, if we want to separate to do, we can also do to do ID. But it's all lowercase, and it's all separated with underscores. And let's say we agreed and on the project level, we want to use snake case for all things. And this is, of course, a problem. It's easy to miss during a code review. You want this to be consistent with all the other instances, but someone just wrote it like you would, for example, do a variable declaration in lower camel case. Now, one point here is, for example, you write your own linter to do all the annoying things. No one likes a colleague who constantly points out, yeah, you have the wrong naming format on your path variables, because you want to get a feature shipped, you don't want to fix some minor things that are in the way of that, and then this annoying colleague always points out, yeah, you named that wrong, you need to fix this. And this is not a blocker, you think, and just say, yeah, let's just go ahead without this. Because there's a human component. You see a person on the other side of the code review, and this person says, oh, yeah, this person is preventing you from getting your job done. If you write a linter, and that's my experience in a big software project with hundreds of engineers, you don't really have day-to-day contact with all of those people. And if you have to review all of those, you quickly get to be the annoying colleague who always stops people from shipping their things. But if you write a linter that runs in the pipeline and prevents everyone from merging their pull requests, it's suddenly not a problem anymore. And everyone thinks, oh yeah, thankfully the linter stopped me from committing that. Or thankfully the linter stopped me from merging that because I missed something here. And that's the idea behind it, behind writing your linter for these tedious code review tasks that you don't want to do. Of course, we not only have this in this place here. If we take a look at the handler function here, so this is the update. Of course, we have the path value extraction here. We also need to fix it at this place. We need to replace this with a snake case. And of course, if we take a look at the list endpoint, we have some query parameters. There we have one correctly named query parameter and some not so correctly named query parameters. They're either lower camel case, they're upper snake case, they're all uppercase, and we want, and keep up case we also have here. And we want to filter that out. Now you think, okay, let's just write a regex. We can do this because this all follows the pattern of r.ul.query.get. Now the problem is we can also do something like this. We can assign the result of r.ul.query to a variable, query values, and then we can call query values.get because programming languages allow you to do that. And suddenly you can't match it with a regex anymore. So we have to take out one bigger gun, and this is, of course, writing our own linter. And taking the abstract syntax tree, checking, okay, this is where we have a URL.values type, and someone calls get on it, we know we have the right function that we want to lint now. So how does this look in the end? So we can run our finished linter here. We also implemented fixing things, like if you find something, we can automatically say we want this fixed. And I don't want it fixed right away because this is my example project and I don't want to modify it. I can just print a diff instead. So I haven't run this in a few months, I guess, but nothing should have changed. The thing is, with Go run, it first needs to compile it and then run it, so it takes a bit longer than if you had a pre-compiled linter. But yeah, it says here, we need to replace the to-do ID with to-do ID, lower camel case. And we need to replace this r.path value call with this one in order to fix things. We don't have a fix or a diff fix for the query parameters because that would be a breaking change. And we don't want our linter to automatically introduce breaking changes into our source code. But if we don't run it with fix and diff, it would point out that this query parameter should be the snake case contains text. For example, uppercase contains text, should be lowercase contains text. It just converts this automatically into snake case. It doesn't check if it makes sense from a linguistic standpoint, like you would introduce a underscore in contains text, but it can auto-convert whatever you have here, check if it is lower camel case, and print out both variants and tell you off for doing the wrong thing here. So how do we do that? I said before we need to create an instance of analysis.analyzer. And it's pretty easy to run this. We have a main function, and we can just say single checker.main and pass in our instance of the analyzer, and that will parse the Go code, pass it to our run function, and then print out the results for one analyzer. If you want to integrate this into some more or further, bigger linter projects, then you would use something Golang CI lint, and Golang CI lint also wants this. So it's already ready to be integrated and into this GoLinter. Then we have our run function, which gets this pass instance here. And what we need to do is we need to check all the files that we're given. And then we're calling ast.inspect. And now we're getting a callback for all of the nodes that we have in the file. And what we're doing here is we're checking, is the current node a call to path parents? And if yes, then we execute whatever is in this if. We check, is the current node a call to query.getParent? Or a call to query.get? If yes, then we execute... please go away. Okay, then we execute this case here. Is it a call to get path value? Then we execute this part, and that's just the basic logic. If we have a call to that, we do some more processing. We're using a library here to just convert it to snake case, and we're comparing, is the original value the same if we just convert it, which allows you to quickly check if this needs to be modified. And if it does, we just call pass.report, which creates a linter finding. If we pass in the position, it will automatically render it as such here. So this is a clickable link in my IDE that I can just go to and see where exactly is the linter finding in the code, and it makes fixing these things so much quicker. Then we have a message. And if we want to support fixing this automatically, we can do suggested fixes. Here we just say we need to edit the text. We need to do it from this position to this position. And we need to have a new text in here. And this is how we can automatically provide fixes that can be auto-fixed by the linter. So how do we find, or how do we check if our current node is an interesting node? We do it, for example, with query get parent. So what we want to check here is the existence of this call here. We're calling get on URL.values. And this is the interesting thing, or the thing we're interested in here. We first of all need to filter out, is this even a call expression? If it's not a call expression, then it can't be a call to a specific function. So we try to cast the node that we have here, the generic node, into an AST.call expression. If this doesn't work, we get a false here, which means we just return and say, yeah, this is not an interesting node. We skip that in our AST.inspect, and everything's fine. Then we say, so the function call we have needs to be a selector expression, because we're doing dot get. So we need to cast the function that we're calling into a selector expression. It helps to keep in mind the tree layout that we showed before in the slides in your head and see, yeah, we have a call expression, then we have the function, which can be a selector expression, and so on. So it makes a lot more sense here. If this isn't a selector expression, of course, we need to go out. It doesn't make sense. And then we see if the thing in the selector expression is a get. And this is how we can do it here with a selector expression, selection.name, get. And if this isn't the case, it can't be a get function call because we just ruled that out. Now, it could be a .get on something completely unrelated, and we don't want to have false positives where we just annoy the programmer and make people just put linter ignores everywhere because it's just annoying and things get skipped. We really want to avoid that. So we need to do some further checks. We now confirmed it's a function call with a selector expression, and what we're calling is the get method on it. So we now need to check what exactly are we calling the get method on it. So the type check here differs a bit between identifiers and expressions. What's the difference here? This thing here is the thing we're now type checking. And r.url.query is an expression. It's something that returns a value that we can further call .get on. This thing here is not an expression, it's an identifier. Also a kind of expression, but we can do another way of type checking it directly. So we do that. It's not an intermediate value, it's a variable that we call get on. So we have the two cases. We have either it can be an AST.ident, so an identifier, or it can be a selector expression, or another call expression. If we have, for example, .query, which is a call expression which returns something again. And I wrote two helper functions that allow me to quickly type check something. We just say, yeah, this expression here, please make sure it's of net URL values. And that makes it pretty easy to just say, yeah, if it's not that, then it can't be our get call, and we just return false. And if it's neither of that, I couldn't think of any case where it would be something else. So I just said, yeah, then it's also not something we're interested in. And then we can use the type system again to check if the argument here is a constant value. If it isn't, it's not possible to check via linter. So either we can say, let's report a finding, say you have to have your query parameters known at compile time, for example. That would be an option. Or we can just say, yeah, it's dynamic. Let's just hope this gets fine during code review and not block the engineer here when developing that. But if it's const, then we can extract the value as in the parameter, and we can get this out and compare it against it being snake case or not. So how do these work? I think the identifier one is the easier one. We have this type info that I showed before in the linter pass. And in this case, what we have is a uses. Like we're using an identifier in some other context. So this is how we can look it up. We just take the identifier, we pass it into the uses map, and we get something out. It's an object type. If we don't have it, this again is a pattern in Go. It's a second return type here, or second return value. If we don't find it, we don't get anything here, and we can return false because, we don't have the type info here. We can't do any further checks. We can then find out the type that we have here. If it's a pointer, that's another layer of indirection. What we can do here is just say, yeah, we want to unwrap this pointer. We want to know what it's pointing to. We need to do this in some cases. And then afterwards, we can check if it's a named type. And this is what we want. We want it to be a named type because what we put in here is a package and a name. And of course, a named type has a name. Then we can compare of this name type the package path and the object name. And if both is the same, then this identifier here is of this type from this package and has this name here. This is, for example, for these cases where we have a type type alias, for example, then we want to unwrap that and get to the underlying type because we can't compare the name of a pointer, for example. And basically the same thing also works with expressions. In this case, we just have type info.types. We look that up and basically have to, kind of the same logic. And in this case here, we get the const value by looking it up again in types. And we get a type and value out of it. In the above case here, we use the type. In this case, we use the value. If it's null, then it's not a compile time constant. And we can just we return an empty string as an indicator that this isn't a compile time value. And if it's not, then we can do a trick here and basically call string on any thing that implements the string interface and just render it out into a string. In our case, we just have these string values because we're always comparing string values in this code. But of course, you can improve this to work with more types than just string. And that's basically how this all works. We just have one additional complication. If we take a look at this one here, if we get the string out of it, we get this whole string. So now we want to parse out the placeholders here. And this is the part where you can fall back onto the earlier solution and just use regex. This thing here is in the non-complicated cases parsable by regex. And that's just easily doable. We just look for things within the braces here. And we can get out this value or these values because they can be multiple. And then we have the to-do ID here. And that's all to it. We can run the linter, get these results here. And if we take, for example, this one here and fix it, contains text, run the linter again, we can see that it no longer shows up in the results here. And that's how you write your own linter routes in Go. Do you have any questions about that? If not, I have some bonus provided by my colleague who did the same thing for the front-end part. So we have a front-end project, and we have a... probably don't have this installed. So I can't run it, but I can show it to you. This is for front-end development. And what we have here is a view component. It just shows those red lines because I haven't installed the dependencies here. It's a view component for this exact to-do server. So we're closely aligned here. And we prepared basically front end and back end that works together that you could run in the workshop and so on. And this here uses some old syntax for declaring emit functions or emits. Basically, whenever a part of the web page wants to tell its parents, hey, I have an event, it does so by emitting something. This is view terminology. And this changed. And we wanted this to be not this line here, but what we want is update to do. And we have string boolean. So, and that's a new syntax. The problem now is that we lost some interesting information here. Because beforehand, we saw that the string was an ID and that the boolean was indicating the done status. We couldn't really leave it out because that doesn't work. We can't just say, yeah, that's just a string or that's just a boolean. We need a parameter name. And here it's kind of optional because now we have just the type information here. We can do this like this. This also works. But it's not mandatory anymore. You don't get a compile error. And my colleague Mark checked that there is no linting rule for this yet, apparently. So he just said, yeah, he wanted to write his own. And basically, this is a linting rule for ESLint that we had the participants create. It enforces the tuples within the define emits to be named. So exactly this name to be included here. And what you had to do here is we wanted to take a look at the tuple node. And because the AST is very restricted in this part of the code, we can just say, yeah, we want to go that many levels up the AST. We know that there will be that many parents. So, we just go up to the define emits expression. I have the wrong branch here. I'm just seeing where it's not yet implemented. But basically, it has all the same things here. We want to make sure that it's part of a define emits, so we need to check this define emits if it is actually a define emits call. And then we need to check that all members of this node here are named members. What we can check here is this actually... So there's actually an AST Explorer that we can take a look, and we can see for this component here, which is the same thing that you just saw in the IDE, we can take a look at the AST. So we go to the descriptor. We want to check things up here, which is the script setup part, the script setup AST. And then we see here, we have an import declaration, another import declaration, an expression statement for the defined props, and a variable declaration for the defined emits. And we can see that here in this call expression, we called define emits. So we need to check in the call expression here that the callee type is identifier and that the name is define emits. So we lint the right location here. And then we have the type parameters. And in this type parameter here, we see that this T is type literal. Exactly in here. This one, this string, is not named. It doesn't have the ID in front of it. And this boolean is named. It has a bool in it. So we have one tsString keyword, which is a string. Of course, it says so. And then we have one tsNamed tuple member. And basically, what we then can check in the AST is that all of these element types within this are of the type tsNamed tuple member. And if we have anything else, that's a linter problem, and we can report that. And now's the question, how do you implement that in ESLint? You need to wrap this in some definitions here. In this case, we say it's a problem, not just a warning. We have some docs for the description. We have our processing rule here, how this thing is processed. And then we have to define a plugin. We define the rule name, like define emits parent names. We pass in the definition that we had in the other file here. And we then need to feed it into the ESLint config, which isn't done here. But basically, you need to say it, please pick up this plugin. And then it is included in your front-end linting. And basically, if you have full-stack development with a JavaScript web application and a Go backend, this is how you can do full-stack linting rules with your own custom linting rules and implement your custom project rules that you don't want to repetitively check in all your code reviews. And now that's it. Any questions?
Okay, doesn't seem like we have any questions. Thank you for your talk. And give another warm round of applause, please.
So if you have any follow-up questions afterwards, please do so after the teardown and after the closing, because I'll probably be busy then.